Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Hearing set for Monday to hear Judge Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Baisley Ford under mounting pressure from senators of his own party. Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, will call Judge Brett Kavanaugh and the woman who has accused him of sexual assault, Dr. Christine Baisley Ford, before the committee on Monday for public hearings. In setting the hearing, Grassley backed down from holding a committee vote on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination planned for this coming Thursday and pushed a confirmation, once seen as inevitable, into limbo. Yesterday, both Senators Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, and Jeff Flake from Arizona said that if true, Blasey's accusations would disqualify the nominee from the Supreme Court. The process for the hearing has not been determined. Committee Chair Grassley outlined a plan to limit testimony to that provided by Kavanaugh and Ford. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the committee, said it was impossible to take this process seriously, noting that 22 witnesses appeared at the hearing in 1991 when law professor Anita Hill accused Supreme Court nominee Justice Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. I think this new mantra coming from Republicans, "she must be heard," is an indicator that Kavanaugh is losing support. And some Republicans are looking for a way out on this one. It'll be interesting to see what develops over the rest of this week. A week can be an eternity in politics. Syria shoots down Russian plane during Israeli missile attack. A Russian naval patrol aircraft, an Ilyushin IL-20, was downed by Syrian air defense systems Monday night as it was flying over the Mediterranean Sea while returning to an airbase in Latakia, Syria. As a result, 15 military personnel were killed. Russian President Putin has characterized the incident as an unfortunate case of tragic circumstances, and the Russian Defense Ministry has described the case as resulting from a deliberate provocation staged by Israel for the purpose of placing the IL-20 in the target sites of Syrian anti-aircraft systems. The IL-20 disappeared from the radar as four Israeli F-16 fighter jets attacked Syrian government facilities in Latakia while deliberately using the IL-20 as cover. Rather than firing on the attacking jets, however, the Syrian S-200 air defense batteries attacked the allied Russian plane instead, whose reflective surface is far greater than the far more advanced U.S.-made fighter jets. Whether it's the U.S. backing ISIS or Idlib, or this incident, people have to ask, why are the U.S., Saudis, and Israelis trying to desperately provoke incidents and conflict? DOJ orders two Chinese state-run media organizations to register as foreign agents. The Department of Justice has ordered two Chinese media organizations with strong ties to China's government to register as foreign agents in the U.S. The Wall Street Journal reported today that the Department of Justice has ordered Xinhua News Agency and China Global Television Network, CGTN, to register as foreign agents amid a U.S. effort to ramp up efforts to combat foreign interference in media and political groups. Xinhua News Agency is the country's largest news organization, while CGTN operates a collection of six TV channels in different languages. I don't think it's a coincidence that as the U.S. is escalating the trade war with China, that the DOJ makes this move. Also, there's a huge difference between two very credible news organizations such as these and alleged interference in media and political groups. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Under mounting pressure from senators of his own party, Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, will call Judge Brett Kavanaugh and the woman who has accused him of sexual assault, Dr. Christine Ford, before the committee on Monday for public hearings. What does this mean for the Kavanaugh nomination going forward? Have times really changed with the Me Too movement? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She is the co-producer of the Lukeman Nation, activist and commentator Jackie Lukeman. Jackie, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Leon.
Thank you for joining us. And also, we're joined, he's the third vice chair of the Maryland Republican Party and a Republican strategist, CEO of Eugene Craig Organization. Eugene Craig, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hey, glad to be on your show. Glad to be back. Can't complain.
Thank you so much for joining us. Jackie, let me start with you. So on Thursday, 13th, Kavanaugh was sailing through on his way to confirmation. Then on Friday, the 14th, the New York Times breaks a story about an anonymous woman who we now know as Dr. Christine Ford, who has sent a letter to Senator Feinstein alleging that a 17-year-old Brett Kavanaugh, then a student at Georgetown Prep, had been drinking at a social gathering when he and a male friend, Mark Judge, took her into a bedroom. The door was locked. She was thrown on a bed. Kavanaugh got on top of her, put his hands over her mouth. Music was turned up, according to the account, and he tried to assault her. Now, the confirmation vote has been postponed, and we're on our way to another hearing on Monday. Jackie, your thoughts on these developments?
The developments are disturbing, but I think for me, what's even more disturbing is that this is the event that has stalled the development, has stalled his confirmation, and not the revelation that he didn't tell the truth, that Kavanaugh wasn't telling the truth about receiving stolen documents from Manuel Miranda. He was asked about this particular incident of the stolen documents from the Democratic Party while he was serving in the Bush administration. He was asked about it in 2004, 2006, and last week, specifically these documents, and he said, no, I never received them, three times now. But these emails that have come out, which were not released in 2004 and 2006 when he was being confirmed for the judiciary, no one had access to them, but now they've come out and there is a clear paper trail that shows that Miranda sent Kavanaugh these documents. So why this confirmation wasn't stalled when this information came out that Kavanaugh did not tell the truth about those documents, that's disturbing enough. But what's even more disturbing to me now that these allegations have come out against Kavanaugh from Dr. Ford is that this seems to be all for show, because from what I understand, the confirmation hearings are only going to be held up for 2 days. The vote is still planned for Wednesday. So I don't know what this means. I can look at it and say, from the Republicans, it's window dressing. They're doing this because they have to. But just by the way they are scheduling to continue 2 days later to go ahead with the votes, it doesn't appear that they're taking this seriously at all.
Eugene Craig, your thoughts?
They're taking it pretty seriously, and I'll tell you why, because his vote has been delayed. It's been canceled for now. The thing is that, if the votes were there, Mitch would definitely drive this through. Would absolutely drive it through without any regard, any second thought, just get it done. You know, the majority may be gone, this time in January. They're taking it absolutely seriously. The second part of that is that when it comes to the committee, this thing could very well die in committee or go to the floor without a positive recommendation. And I'm of the belief that, hey, if somebody like a Jeff Flake were to vote against this in committee, they'll be also prone to vote against it on the floor. And I doubt that he would be alone, which would mean that this nomination would probably die on the floor. So I think absolutely, Kavanaugh nomination absolutely is in jeopardy right now.
What does this say about a change in time? Is there a change in time since with the Me Too movement since we went through this with the Anita Hill hearing, and has the Me Too movement put this in a different space in terms of the American political thought process, Jackie?
I think it has put the American consciousness in a different thought process. Because I remember watching the Anita Hill testimony at Clarence Thomas's hearing, and I remember the conversations I was having with people, and I actually broke up with a guy I was dating over the Anita Hill testimony. I believed her, he didn't, and it was one of those things where it was like, why would a woman come out and subject herself to this kind of horrendous scrutiny if she were not telling the truth? It is better understood that no woman in her right mind would do that. Not even after all this time, because of the callousness and the still and the continued hostility toward women who accuse especially powerful, high-profile men of sexual assault. It is better understood now why women wait or why women don't tell people, because of that public putting the victim on trial. So in that regard, the Me Too movement has changed the public consciousness in regard to sexual assault. And we know more about college campus assault and date rape especially, but it remains to be seen how that will affect this confirmation. I would love to be wrong that he will be confirmed. I hope I am. I really do.
Eugene, your thoughts. Has the Me Too movement moved the American consciousness to a point to where the accusations of Dr. Ford are having a greater impact than they did or would or the what we went through with Anita Hill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we're in a time where you're seeing, board members of Fortune 500 companies, you know, being dismissed, CEOs being punished, and a level playing field and the power dynamic. And it's absolutely as a result of the Me Too movement. And it's not just something that's happened at the higher levels, something that's happened at, you know, in everyday life. I mean, you know, I think if the Me Too movement had existed, you know, I was 1 year old when Justice Thomas was going through his confirmation. But
to be young again.
But the thing is that if Anita Hill had a Me Too movement behind her, I mean, you couple that with the brilliance of Michelle Robinson, who was one of her counsels at the time. You get a pretty amazing dynamic, to say the least.
Eugene, I want to come back to you with this question. The process, as I understand it, the process has not been determined. Grassley is trying to minimize the number of witnesses, trying to limit it to Kavanaugh and Ford. Feinstein and others are trying to expand it. The fact that Grassley is trying to limit this to the degree that it is tells me that he's really trying to do the bare minimum to get this through. Because what we're going to have is he said, she said. We realize that. But
yeah,
we know that Dr. Ford spoke to a therapist about this. We know that Dr. Ford spoke to her husband about this years ago. So, and we also know that now people will say, that's not solid evidence. Yeah, but we know that a lot of cases are built on less than solid evidence. So what does this say anything that Grassley is trying to limit the witness pool down to two people instead of actually giving the American people an opportunity for this thing to be truly flushed out?
The thing is this, isn't a court of law. This is a political committee. And when it comes to things of political nature, public perception and public opinion reign supreme. And so the Grassley, as chairman of judiciary, and the shepherd of this nomination, per se, his number one, unspoken goal is to manage public perception and public opinion. And when, Kavanaugh, is already on the rocks because of the person who nominated him, and that person's...
Wait a minute, Gene. I thought Grassley swore an oath to uphold the Constitution against enemies foreign and domestic. I thought that was his primary goal or his primary responsibility.
That's his goal. That's his responsibility. That's his responsibility as a U.S. senator. But when it comes to the role that folks have assumed in this process, this is a big threat of party politics, where the party and the ideology take precedent over the processes and the actual outcomes, or affect the outcomes. And so the thing is that with the Kavanaugh, nomination, Grassley knows if he allows too many witnesses or this thing is too credible, it will taint the Kavanaugh nomination. You turn the public against it, it not only will hurt, a lot of folks' reelection chances in 18, but you'll feel the backlash in 2020 as well.
So, Jackie, again, circumstantial evidence such as Dr. Ford speaking to her therapist, Dr. Ford speaking to her husband to refute the allegation that this is politically motivated and driven. It seems as though Chuck Grassley trying to narrow this to two witnesses, as opposed to allowing corroborating, even though they would be circumstantial, corroborating witnesses, seems like politics to me.
Well, it's absolutely politics. And unfortunately, considering the facts around how this accusation has played out, and the response from Kavanaugh, he was very interestingly well prepared with a list of 60 or 65 women who allegedly knew him in high school and college who signed a letter saying that they had nothing negative to say about them and about him and vouching for his character. Well, if it is the purpose of the GOP to get him nominated to exonerate him of these allegations, then why can't those 60 to 65 women that Kavanaugh's people have presented as character witnesses be vetted? It's odd that they were conveniently there. They just knew these 60 women just out of nowhere at the drop of a hat. You could just call up these 60 women, and that's odd enough. But limiting the testimony to just two people also keeps out of the public record what was said or what Dr. Ford's therapist would like to share, which would corroborate her story and her husband. So that's purely political.
And see, let me just jump in there real quick and say, see, I don't think that 60 women should be brought in to vouch for Kavanaugh's character. The character issue has been covered throughout the hearing. Everybody on the Republican side started their conversation with, oh, he's a wonderful guy. He's a great basketball coach. I mean, a whole lot of stuff that means nothing when it comes to being a jurist. But I believe if someone is coming in to testify about an event and we don't have corroborating evidence, or at least direct evidence about the event, circumstantial evidence about the event would be relevant. Eugene?
Oh, absolutely. The thing is this, this similar to the impeachment, they're innately just purely political processes. They're purely political processes. Which to a degree, the evidence matters, but evidence kind of doesn't matter. And that's what, I think a lot of, members of the judiciary and
wait a minute. Evidence in this issue doesn't matter?
No, not in this particular issue. I'm talking in the process in general.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's the reason why, you know, so much has been spent on the branding of Kavanaugh rather than the record of Kavanaugh. I mean, we look at the record of Kavanaugh. The record of Kavanaugh says that he's horrible on the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. You know, he was pro-torture. You know, he's been involved in some crazy stuff.
And he's lied. And he's lied in a couple of hearings.
The branding of Kavanaugh, on the other hand, you know, says, oh, he's a great dad. He's a great basketball coach, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know, and the thing is that this is a court of law. This is a process that was solely dependent upon facts. You know, none of that would matter. But because this is an innately political process, and, you know, it's about the branding. It's about the perception.
Okay, I'm up against the clock, so let me stop you there. Let me ask this question to Jackie and Eugene. I'll come to you. You each have about 45 seconds to answer. So, Jackie, when we're done with these hearings on Monday, where are we?
When we are done with these hearings on Monday, we're still dealing with a terrible, terrible nominee, someone who has 77 civil rights groups that came out against the nominee, against him as a nominee, has a horrible record on civil rights, including his views on voting rights, affirmative action, equal employment, fair housing, and criminal justice. The GOP is closing ranks around him, and so is Trump. So we are not only left with a horrible, horrible Supreme Court nominee, we're also looking at a morally bankrupt GOP. That are using, as they have always done, the political process to cover for them championing policies that really have no standing in any decent morality.
Eugene Craig, Monday when the hearing is over, where are we?
We're looking at, seeing what Jeff Flake could do, seeing what Ben Sasse would do. I think a lot of people are putting too much pressure and attention on Collins and Murkowski. You know, those aren't the votes you need to be looking at. You need to be looking at Flake, Corker, Sasse. You know, those are the folk that have a slight axe to grind with the president. Those are the folk that can use this last moment to stick it to the president. And those are the folk that probably are going to be more principled than your Collins and Murkowski.
Thank you both. Let me tell you where we are. Monday, when this is over, Dr. Ford is an incredible witness with a very ugly story. They're going to come at her hard on some things that really don't matter, such as here you are at 51 and you can't remember exactly where the party was when you were 15 years old. They're going to try to pick her apart with that. And at the end of the day, Sasse and Flake and Corker, they're going to bail along with Collins and Murkowski. I think they lose at least 5 Republicans by the end of Monday, because I don't see how Kavanaugh can refute this. Other than saying it didn't happen, I'm a wonderful guy, and let me help you with your jump shot. I don't think he can mount a good enough defense to the story that this woman is about to tell. We'll see where we are next week. Jackie Lukman, thank you so much. Eugene Craig, greatly appreciate it. We'll bring you back. Maybe we'll bring you guys back on Monday if you're available, and we can talk about what we witnessed on Monday. How about that?
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you, Eugene. I greatly appreciate it. Jackie, thank you. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Inside Arabia launches unprecedented hashtag Save Yemen campaign aimed at UN General Assembly. As the UN General Assembly session gets underway in New York this week, Inside Arabia is launching hashtag Save Yemen, a massive public awareness campaign demanding that the United Nations act now to stop the war that has resulted in the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Thousands of Yemeni civilians are being slaughtered and millions are at risk of starving to death or dying of preventable diseases. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She is the editor-in-chief for Inside Arabia, Elizabeth Myers. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much.
This has to be one of the most underreported stories in U.S. corporate media. So first, let's talk a bit about what's actually going on in Yemen, and then what is the Inside Arabia campaign?
So what's going on in Yemen? By way of background, basically, it started out as a civil war about 3 years ago. In March of 2015, it became a disproportional intervention by 9 separate outside foreign powers that formed a coalition led by Saudi Arabia to essentially prop up the current existing government under President Hadi. Since then, the coalition forces have launched a number of airstrikes, thousands and thousands of airstrikes, as a matter of fact, killing many civilians, destroying many civilian targets that would or otherwise normally not be on strike lists under international humanitarian law. And there's been a lot of destruction of the country in other ways as well. We're about to run a story that will detail historical artifacts, archaeological remains, the flora and fauna of a UNESCO-protected historical site, World Historical Site Island. And there's been a lot of death and destruction. And so last week, there was an attempt to start talks between the parties in Geneva. The Houthi parties did not make it there for whatever reasons. They claimed logistical reasons that they couldn't actually get out of Yemen. I don't know what the facts are on that. That remains to be seen. But the situation is just really dire for the civilian population. You have children who are starving to death. You have many people who are now facing and suffering from illnesses that Yemen has not seen in decades, like cholera, diphtheria, and measles, preventable by virtue of simply having access to the medicine. But one of the things that has been absolutely critical in really decimating the human population there has been a blockade, which has been in effect since pretty soon after the coalition forces started targeting Yemen. So we're talking 3 years, basically, of a total blockade by air, sea, and land. So what that means is no food, no clean water, no medicines. And so the situation is extremely, extremely dire, such that the UN Secretary General back in April, months ago now, called it the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
In fact, the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis.
Man-made, exactly.
And what the American audience really needs to understand is this: the escalation of these atrocities was really greenlit during the Obama administration and are now being carried out and continued by the Trump administration. So it's American tax dollars that are going into logistical support for the Saudi Air Force and military. It is refueling of fighter planes in the air. It is American weaponry that is being used to enhance and to facilitate the Saudi and the other coalition forces' decimation of the civilian population in Yemen.
That's correct. And as late as last week, last Wednesday, there was a certification that the Secretary of State issued to Congress, because Congress has manifested its concern about the humanitarian destruction and devastation there. And the certification was given last Wednesday, I believe, that the coalition forces are ostensibly using all means at their disposal to minimize casualties that are non-combatants. Since then, human rights organizations have disputed that. But that's where we are. The certification was given, and therefore we are continuing that refueling of Saudi flights, Saudi airplanes, et cetera.
And the logistical support is very important, because one of the more horrific events that took place a couple of weeks ago was the bombing of a school bus full of children. And there's no way that that bus could have been targeted without American support, because again, Americans are providing, the American military is providing logistical support and coordination of targets. So we're basically bombing buses full of children.
Yeah, and that, and that's part of the horror of this war. The Saudis have finally, after claiming initially that that was a, quote, legitimate military target, they have backed off that and said now that was a, quote, mistake. But that's another thing that human rights organizations are disagree with, that in fact the targeting has been deliberate of those kinds of targets. And in fact, the UN report that was issued on August 28th, just I guess 2 weeks ago today, really accuses all sides of war crimes. So the situation, if it's not stopped, it's unconscionable, just unconscionable.
So the United Nations General Assembly is getting underway in New York for its annual meeting this week, and Inside Arabia is launching a hashtag Save Yemen massive public awareness campaign. Explain the motivation behind the campaign. What, in terms of raising awareness, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish from that raised awareness? And what is the mission and the objective of the campaign?
So the motivation behind it essentially is humanitarian. We're not necessarily taking any political stance, but the situation on the ground, destroying a country and a people that has a civilization going back to the beginnings of human civilization, is so serious and so unconscionable that our president and CEO has felt that it has to come into the open, because it really has been a hidden war, hidden in the sense that the narrative has been controlled by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, and they have not let, to the extent possible, the truth come out. So our feeling about it is that the truth must come out, and that's what we've tried to do. Through the month of August, we ran about 5 or 6 different stories on Yemen, the various atrocities. We also ran an amazing story about the island of Socotra, which is the one I was talking about, the UNESCO World Heritage Site, to show that this is devastation of proportions that are just totally unconscionable. And so our motivation is to bring that out, to raise awareness. We've targeted New York because that is where the General Assembly is meeting. And so what we've done, I'll just tell you what is the public awareness campaign. So that's the motivation. What are we doing? Okay. So we have created a series of what we're calling creatives, graphics, that graphically illustrate the problem.
And they're very powerful graphics.
I think they're very powerful. That's what I'm going to try. And, you know, it's kind of too bad we're not on TV, but just to describe what the graphic is, it's a child, a Yemeni child, looking out at the streets and the people of Manhattan with the reflection, with a tear in her eye, and with the reflection of the Saudi and the Emirati flags in her eye. And the captions, the caption is, "The war in Yemen, the world's worst man-made crisis." And we have basically three different creatives focusing on three different facts that are so entirely horrendous. The first, 11 million children in need of humanitarian assistance. The second, the airstrike that you were talking about, the August 9th airstrike that killed 40 children in a school bus. And then the third is about 68 civilians being massacred in one day by one of these airstrikes. And the colors we've picked deliberately. In the background of red at the bottom, the caption reads, "The UN must act." And that's our message. That's our message. We've launched it in New York City as of Saturday. As of Sunday morning, people were waking up to these images being plastered on the backs and the sides of buses, on the backs and the sides of video billboards that are on trucks rotating, circulating around the city. And also, we have them on 50 kiosks. They're like little video kiosks that you find as you're walking down the street. You see an ad. Okay, normally you'd see a Macy's ad, right? But next to Macy's, instead, we've got the war in Yemen, world's worst man-made crisis.
I guess the real objective here is, since very few people, A, even know where Yemen is, let alone know that this catastrophe is being engaged in, it's going to pique interest and get people to go to their phones. What's going on?
Yeah, to go to their phones and click on that hashtag Save Yemen, so that we can get the word out.
So when they click on the hashtag, what happens?
They can retweet. They can go to our tweet. They can basically use the hashtag to communicate that they're on the subject. People can see their tweets. They basically can see anything that's been posted with that hashtag. Just this the same as any other, live hashtag discussion.
And how long of a campaign is this going to be?
So we launched on Saturday the 15th, and it will run through the end of the month, September 30th, the whole run of the General Assembly meeting.
And I assume you have metrics or ways to capture the metrics to determine the number of clicks, the number of eyes that this is reaching.
Well, that is something we're working on with our media company. I don't have a definitive answer on that, but hopefully we just launched and we're kind of recovering from the immediate fallout of that. All of a sudden, everybody's interested. I'm getting a lot of emails from.
Okay, so it's already having an impact.
It's already happening, and we have a number of, there are peace projects, there are human rights organizations that we're in contact with now, wondering what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I have to say, it's the humanitarian issue that's driving this. It's really not necessarily politics, but it's to stop a really horrendous crisis.
The why you're doing it, in terms of people asking why you, what is the nature of that question? Does my question make sense?
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, I think it kind of gets down to, well, who's paying for all this? You know, I think people are wondering about that, and I think they also wonder about our name being Inside Arabia, and they wonder, are you affiliated with Saudi Arabia? And no, the answer is no. We have nothing. We're entirely an independent media company, independently funded, and we're in the process of seeking a 501c3 nonprofit status, which means that we will be sustained by individual contributions once that's approved. Mm-hmm. And we have nothing to do with any government. It's really an individual, passion motivated response to the inaction of the powers that could do something about it.
So the why you're doing it is really more of a who's behind it, as opposed to
that's what we're getting.
Okay. Because once you get some level of understanding of what's going on, then the why answers itself. So that's why.
Right. This is not a small undertaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been planned for months. I wasn't at liberty to tell you about it last week when I came on, but it's been planned for months, and this costs a lot of money, a lot of money. We have a huge billboard. You know the billboards that are in Times Square?
Yes.
We're not in Times Square. We're at 34th Street and 7th Avenue. It's near Herald Square, near Macy's. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge billboard that will have that on it as well, scrolling through along with the Volvo ads and whatever. But,
gotcha.
But
as
so
a
this
former
is,
Volvo guy, that's a good.
Boxy, but nice, right?
Exactly. So in wrapping up, what are the three things that you want someone to do after they've seen your ad campaign or after they've listened to this conversation? What are the three things you want them to do?
So first of all, I would like them to go to our website and check out all the articles that we've had so far on Yemen, so they get the full picture of the destruction and the significance of that destruction to an ancient civilization. Second of all, I want them to use that hashtag. I want to use the hashtag Save Yemen to use all of their social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, forward the tweets that we are putting out there, forward the Instagrams, to make the most impact of this, of our graphics mm-hmm. and our creatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth Myers, editor-in-chief from Inside Arabia.
And maybe I should give the website again.
Oh, well, let's do it.
Okay. So it's http://insidearabia.com.
Hashtag save Yemen.
Exactly.
Hashtag save Yemen. Again, Elizabeth Myers, Inside Arabia, editor-in-chief. Thank you so much. And we'll bring you back to get an update on the success of this effort.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back. You're tuned to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Today, McDonald's workers are demanding an end to sexual harassment. An unprecedented hashtag MeToo movement strike started today at lunchtime at McDonald's restaurants in 10 cities, including San Francisco, Chicago, and Miami. And for insight into what's going on, we turn to my next guest. He's a diversity strategist. He's author of Rip the Resume, Torin Ellis. Welcome to The Critical Hour.
My man, Dr. Wilmer Leon, how are you?
Sir, I am great. I am great in yourself. And thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. And, you know, I appreciate you for giving me a few moments. What we got this evening?
Well, this McDonald's workers hashtag MeToo movement strike today regarding sexual harassment. First of all, very few people would have put, I think, McDonald's and sexual harassment in the same sentence.
I don't see why. I don't see why not.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it for just a moment. First of all, this is a big smack for the organization, and I hope that it makes them realize that whatever they've been doing to remedy their culture, their environment, whatever they've been doing in terms of training, professional development, rewriting of corporate policy, hopefully they speed it up and they take seriously the accusations and the complaints that have been lodged by some 27 to 30 women dating back to 2016. And the challenge that I see for individuals who don't feel like it's important or they didn't see this coming, it happens. I mean, I'm not suggesting that in fast food there's more egregious acts than, let's say, inside of a law firm or a white-collar organization. But the bottom line is it's a transient place of employment. The wages are fairly low, if you will. And so people tend to see it as a loose environment. And you know what, Dr. Leon, I'm just going to kind of say some off-the-cuff stuff to you. And I'm not really worried about who's around me that hears those comments to you. And we don't necessarily deem them to be offensive when, in fact, they could be.
Workers are reportedly upset with McDonald's failure to address groping, propositions for sex, and other illegal behavior in restaurants nationwide. And the hashtag MeToo McDonald's strike is also being used to push for better pay. I understand the better pay piece, and this is very interesting. So do you have any idea of in terms of how the strike was being implemented?
In terms of implementation, I'm not sure if it was just a matter of walking out and standing in front of the respective locations, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, 10 or so cities around the country. But what McDonald's has is a larger problem. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 14,000 establishments across the country. I'm sorry, 140,000 establishments across the country. 90% of them are owned by franchisees. And so McDonald's corporate sees that individual ownership as their responsibility. And personally, I feel like if they don't pay attention to how the strike was waged today, in whatever format, whatever fashion that it took on, if they don't pay attention to that and give it the respect that it's needed, it can become a much bigger problem for them. The strikers are backed by the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. They're also being backed by the Fight for 15 Fund, which is to get fast food workers up to $15 per hour. And so they have people that are listening to their complaints. It's not just resting at McDonald's corporate. These individuals have been savvy and smart enough to bring in outside resources to listen to their complaints. And I believe that the climate that we're in right now, the Legal Defense Fund, the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, and Fight for 15 are going to work very hard for not just McDonald's, but for all fast food workers across the country.
Hundreds of McDonald's employees demonstrated outside the company headquarters in Chicago today to draw attention to the alleged sexual harassment at work. They staged a one-day strike across 10 cities in what organizers said would be the first multi-state walkout protesting sexual harassment and also the Fight for 15. It's interesting that this strike is taking place and the hashtag Me Too, as people are talking about the power of Me Too as it relates to the hearing of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And Brett Kavanaugh, now the alleged sexual attack, assault by Brett Kavanaugh, allegedly when he was 17 years old upon a 15-year-old. It's interesting, the correlation between the focus of the McDonald's workers and the sexual harassment of the McDonald's workers at the same time. So my point is, that's an incredible amount of momentum.
It is an incredible amount of momentum. But again, I think it's appropriately timed and not appropriate in the sense of I like it happening today. The bottom line is, in many of these instances, Dr. Leon, men have acted out. And in some cases, women have acted out. And it's been happening for far too long. It's happened in the religious spaces. It's happened in, of course, corporate America. It's happened in the entertainment space. Sean Penn yesterday said that he feels like it's just merely a movement to divide men and women. And then, of course, even former presidential candidate Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden said that he actually regrets how he handled the Anita Hill experience in 1991. And so what I believe is extremely important is that women all across this country, no matter what space you are in, no matter what title you carry, no matter how much money you are making, I encourage, and I'm sure so many others are encouraging them, to just find their voice, find the courage to be able to speak up, to be able to document what you are experiencing in the workplace or outside of the workplace, to be able to reach out to someone in your human resources department or someone above you in a supervisory or managerial position. But make sure that you, with the courage, you document and you follow through. Take action so that we can mitigate these experiences. Dr. Leon, the bottom line is, I don't want anyone to be mischaracterized as being a purveyor of sexual assault or lewd comments. I understand that some of these have been a bit borderline, if you will, but the bottom line is, I want men, the sooner we can encourage women to speak up, and then secondarily, keep our comments to ourselves, keep our hands to ourselves, the better we can make for workplaces all across the country.
You are a expert in diversity, and you're a diversity strategist. You teach, you educate on these issues. I've got to tell you, I am totally befuddled and confused at how it is in 2018 we can still be having these conversations. I worked in corporate America for over 30 years. I didn't understand it 30 years ago, and I don't understand it now. How people have to be trained not to do the things that you just talked about. Keep your hands to yourself, keep your comments to yourself, and respect people in the workplace. Help me out. I when you go in to do these trainings, are you still amazed at the comments that you hear from the people that you're training about, I didn't realize that, you know, asking a woman for sex in the workplace was a bad idea? I mean, are you still shocked when you hear people that don't get it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear, most of my engagements are not focused on training, but it's really on optimizing the way that companies build their teams, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
To say, yes, there is a bit of amazement for me in some cases. And the way that I the cases where I'm most amazed is when the comments are just absolutely, I mean, just meteoric, out of bounds, if you will. I think that for a lot of instances, Dr. Leon, the infractions happen between people who have built some level of rapport, but that at some point, one of the parties decided that they wanted to retreat. They didn't want the relationship to advance any further than it had. One person may have mischaracterized the way the relationship is. Both may have suggested that the relationship between the two of them was further than it was. And so I just think that in a lot of these instances, the infraction is happening between individuals that actually care about one another. I had a guy call me, this true story, called me, I want to say December, January of this year, and literally was in the room with a woman. He was disciplining the woman from an administrative standpoint, and I can't remember if it was for attendance or tardiness or not doing a particular assignment the way that it should be done. But through his counseling, he reached across, and as he was standing up and walking out of the room, he put his hand on her shoulder, and he said, "Listen, I just want you to know that this is part of the policy. We have to have I forget what they call it, a performance improvement plan in place. I'm not concerned with your work. I just need to document. I think that everything is going to be okay." Literally, his hand is on his shoulder. He walks out. 2 days later, he's getting a call from Human Resources, and now he's on the other side of the table having a conversation because she's filed a sexual assault claim against him. And why? Because he's in a supervisory position. So I just know that a lot of these instances, some still surprise me. A lot of them are perhaps questionable, if you will. And I think that a great deal of them happen between individuals who have a relationship with one another. But at some point, it just gets mischaracterized. And unfortunately, it comes off the rails.
Real quick, you know, as I was listening to you and thinking through this and thinking about my own education process, there probably needs to be more discussion about this at the undergraduate level, particularly those who are in business school, those who are seeking business degrees. And I mean, this applies across all disciplines, but I'm just thinking that this needs to be integrated into the dialogue as opposed to some type of standalone training that puts most people to sleep and nobody wants to go to.
So in 2014, Bentley University did a study called the Prepared You Project. And they interviewed some number of recruiters across the country. 60% of those recruiters felt like graduates were not prepared for the workplace because they lacked not the technical skills, Dr. Leon, they
social.
The soft skills, those social skills, communication, corporate mores, just time management.
Okay.
Skills that we need to bring to the workplace. And
gotcha.
I agree with you 1,000%. We need to have that happening at the undergraduate level well before individuals are coming to our workplaces.
Torin Ellis, thank you. So how can people get in contact with you if they are seeking in search of your insight, wisdom, and knowledge?
It's a beautiful thing. Simple, torinellis.com on the web and across all of social media at Torin Ellis.
Torin Ellis, thank you so much for your time and your insight. Greatly appreciate it.
Enjoy the evening, good brother.
Thank you, sir. You've been listening to The Critical Hour. It's another day. It's another Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.